Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
Hello, hello. We just spent about an hour in this room debating Dragon's Dogma 2. It's either phenomenal or it's one of the most unfriendly games of all time.
You know what's so funny? We pre-recorded the wind-up for this week, so we didn't get to do the Dragon's Dogma chat we would have done had we been in work on Monday.
That was the most wound-up we've been in a long time as well.
We just did it off-camera, so maybe we'll do a variation on that again, because I think there is something to say, and you suggested doing this as a podcast. There's something to be said about the vastly differing experiences you can have in a game that doesn't give you a quest marker for everything, or even explain its mechanics in a very robust way.
You know, did you have a thing when you were a tiny child where you started talking to a grown-up next to you thinking it was your parents and it wasn't?
I remember
doing that and how terrified that was. But Dragon's Dogma 2 feels like the gaming equivalent of that, where the argument would be, well, just wander around and see how you get on until you find the home place again.
Yeah.
I want to be with the parents. I want to know where I'm going. I want to know what's going on. And I don't want it to be quest marked to death.
Yeah.
But oh my God, there are so many secrets in that game in a way that I wish I'd seen them.
It's true.
And it's now I'm realizing half the content's been locked off. And I'm Dragons.
It's been a long time since we've played a game but had two completely different experiences. Like, that always happens to a certain degree with you and I, but this one, we might as well be playing different games.
Honestly,
at a certain point.
You're playing Dragon's Dogma. I've just said before we were recording, you're playing Dragon's Dogma 3. I've somehow found a way to play Dragon's Dogma 1 again. I don't know how, but all the extra layers to the quest, you're making forgeries, you're getting NPCs to go along with entire different plot lines.
The discourse is so funny because, you know, some people, rightly so, like yourself, are coming in being like, I'm a bit annoyed at the friction in the game. Whereas I'm coming in and going, Scott, I wish there was more friction in the game. There's not enough. I feel like it's holding my hand too much.
But fairy stones falling out your pockets.
That's partly because I'm combing everything. I mean, I'm living and breathing this game. I'm about 67 hours in, and I'm only to the place that you've arrived at 20 hours.
Which apparently, I'm in this place called Batal. We're not going to talk about Dragon's Dogma for too much longer. But it is like the game of the moment at the minute. I'm in this area called Batal, which is in the southwest of the map, which apparently is an end game area or a late game area. Yeah. And I'm there after about 20 hours. You're three times more hours than me, and you've just got to the start of that entire area.
Literally.
So good stuff.
There's so much to do. You know what? Hey, this is a game that, as of this morning, has sold about 2.5 million copies.
I do love to see that.
And I'm really pleased that that's happened. I'm pleased it's being embraced because it is a bit weird. It is a bit different, and it's not like every other bloody mainstream game at the moment, like Suicide Squad or Skull and Bones and what have you.
Oh my God, I forgot Skull and Bones happened.
Everyone did. Ubisoft did, man.
Yeah, it's still out there ticking away.
Yeah.
It's just them sort of like, it's not even like a neon flashing sign, it's just someone on a street holding a bit of cardboard saying, do you want this?
Those freaks spent about 10 years trying to justify that game and then, oh man, dumped it out without much of anything at all, which is the Ubisoft way these days, Scott Tilford. It's like, have you got games? We've got games, but we're not going to tell you about them. We don't care if they're good. Here you go.
Would you not like that as a Dragon's Dogma 2 fan? Because you can stumble upon them as and when you want.
No, because I'd have to like play a million sort of darts mini games. And they'd all have the same structure as well.
Yeah.
They'd all play like Far Cry 3.
Unlocking parts of the board.
Assassin's Creed 2, yeah.
It's not what you want. And we'll talk about the opposite of that. Stellar Blade's kind of phenomenal.
I don't know if
you played the demo. In fact, I know you have not. You're waiting for the full course.
I'm so excited for the full course that I don't even want to have an appetizer of it. You know what I mean? But I'm excited to hear you talk about it because I've been hyped for this game for a little while. I think the combat looks absolutely sick, but you've actually played it, and does it live up to the hype?
Yeah, I've only played the demo, so it is the thing that's available for a lot of people. Came out on Friday or Saturday most recently, and it's, yeah, I kind of was a bit worried this was going to be too much of a Souls game. Like, I know that Shift Up, the developers, were saying that they were massively inspired by Nier, and they wanted a bit more of that vibe, and it's not, you don't realize how much of a vibe Nier Automata was. I know that game's from 2017, which is 7 years ago at this point, but that game, when you go into Stellar Blade, it's like, it's the music, it's the general feel of exploring this dilapidated environment. Reminded me a lot of Darksiders, which is a franchise no one ever shouts out, but that whole idea of a society used to be here, it was wiped out, and now there are crazy future beings exploring everything and doing acrobatics and fighting each other and whatever. That Darksiders 3 most recently did that, and I just want more Darksiders, to be honest, but I do like that vibe. And yeah, the combat, though, for as much as I thought it was going to entirely be an over-shoulder Souls game, that is one way to play it. You know, but you can just de-lock and play it a lot more like Nier, where it's more like a platinum hack and slash game. It depends on how formidable the particular enemy in front of you is. There's one bit in the demo where you get mobbed by like eight people, all eight creatures all at once. So you're almost more encouraged in that case to try like hacking in various directions and stuff like that. But the moves that you've got are just so much more fun than a standard Souls game in regards to how over the top they are. Like lots of flips, lots of ridiculous stuff, lots of quick time events or occasional quick time events in boss fights, and just a general approach of just giving you flair. Ooh. Like, just obviously the game is so, we need a term for it. Sex forward.
Sex
it needs a term forward. For just, here's, we've got a ridiculously attractive main character, and we're right. Just leaning so much into that. It's all over the marketing. You've got the devs and the CEO guy saying he absolutely loves that stuff, and he has you can make the character half naked in the demo if you want. Like, you can just you can go for that stuff as much as you want. And I think it's super easy to therefore assume that the rest of the game wouldn't have any substance to it. Something that was thought about something like Lollipop Chainsaw back in the day, because it was just so over the top and look how sexy this character is that there's nothing else to it. Not the case back then, not the case with Stellar Blade whatsoever, and that's good.
I was going to ask, you know, you've already mentioned platinum games, so I'm guessing this game with that in mind sort of errs on the Bayonetta side of things.
It's
maybe in terms of the presentation at least, not in terms
a weird
of the combat.
Thing. Because I hate like trying to think of the bucket it would go in. It probably would go in the Souls bucket.
Okay.
But because it's so acrobatic and kinetic and it moves so well, it did remind me of Metal Gear Rising quite a lot. Okay. Like Metal Gear Rising mixed with Nier, mixed with Sekiro's parry mechanic, where if you get the parry at the right time, you'll deflect it almost entirely. They have like a stagger gauge and stuff like that.
That's what I was going to ask, Matt, because everyone in the previews before the demo came out was comparing it to Sekiro and saying how much of a focus there was on that parry mechanic and that gameplay loop. And you just said that is a way to play it, but how integral to the experience is that?
Because I think for me, I found the lock-on to be a bit floaty. Like, it wasn't as like diehard you are fighting this dude in front of you as like a Souls game is. So it made me not want to associate it with that too much. Like, you could lock on in Metal Gear Rising, you can lock on in Nier, but it's not as making you fight like a Souls game. However, when you're doing the boss fights, that's when the Souls stuff comes in.
Right.
Where you're sort of like up close fighting them, parrying, then getting some distance because they're doing a charge attack and they're going to throw a bunch of projectiles at you or whatever. I just think it walks a nice line between the various modern action feels. And to me, as someone who is so dog done with the Souls formula and the Souls feel, I get that it's massively popular, but I've just played too many of them and I'm sick of it. I wasn't too bothered about this, but I was like, I might as well play it anyway because the demo's out. And then being so pleasantly surprised that there are these other, there is this wider feel to it where it does have, you know, it has a foot in the, what I would say is the Metal Gear Rising action camp, where like you're fighting a boss and all of a sudden it's a quick time event, or you're doing these really cool finishers and like things like that.
One of the coolest games of all time, by the way, Metal Gear Rising.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. But yeah, I think we're at a really cool point with the Souls style genre, because I love that formula. You know, I will play every single game that From Software puts out. I'll play all of the imitators, even if they have 10% of the budget. I think Thymessia was a really great one.
I was trying to think of that one.
Yeah.
The one with the big mask.
Yep. I even liked, I've forgotten its name, so I can't like it that much. There's a game where every time you get killed, you sort of get thrown out of your body and your body turns to stone. Completely forgot. But I really enjoyed it. Played that through to completion.
Oh my god, that's the one where you can tank the hit.
You
can hold the button, you can tank it when you're getting hit and hit back. Yeah,
completely forgot.
No,
Someone will say.
Will
tweet us or say in the comments or whatever. But the point is, I think it's cool that we've seen an evolution of it recently, where it's gone a little bit more accessible and a little bit more mainstream, where the ethos of From Software games remain, but you have that maybe flexibility in terms of difficulty, and you have that focus on fast-paced combat and over-the-top combat. You know, I think of Stellar Blade, I think of Star Wars Jedi Survivor, I think of Rise of the Ronin just last month. All of these games that are absolutely indebted to Souls, but don't really play like Souls games.
No, Jedi Survivor is a really good comparison, or Fallen Order, where it's like you can see the Souls DNA, you can feel it when you lock on, you fight a boss, you fight some sort of formidable opponent one-on-one, but overall you're not necessarily thinking in the same mindset as you would in a Souls game.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just to say that, and also like on the protagonist side, like you can't get away from the fact, obviously, like I think it's Sun Jeon is the South Korean model that was the main character was based on, but then even the game is even more voluptuous, more over the top. Like personally, I have zero problem with that, whatever. But in regards to that, there's an assumption that she would be an extremely threadbare surface level character, and she's not. Like I actually really like the stakes that are present in the opening. It reminds me a little bit of Ocarina of Time. And I think that as much as there's, like I said, absolutely an assumption that it's just, it's a sexy old game with nothing else to it. It's not. Like, this is only the second game from these devs. Mm. And it's hilarious if you want to go down the sex horn route. Their first game was like a mobile game just full of large-chested waifus. If you're into that kind of thing. And they seem to have taken all the money from that mobile game and then just gone completely out there with this thing.
I never knew that's where they originated. I didn't know they were only two games into
Well, I was like, where have they come from? They're called Shift Up, and they're a South Korean dev, and Sony apparently helped get this thing over the finish line. And that's another side of it, is that the PS5 tech in here, it feels like a PS5 showcase, even though it's not a first-party title. But it does that thing that Astrobot does, where if you're standing in the rain, you can feel the pitter-patter in the controller.
Oh, I love that.
And I was like, that's literally Sony's devs, Sony's engineers going, this is how you do this. If it's raining, do that. And so it ends up burning through the DualSense in like half an hour, because everything has its own shutter and all that kind of stuff, which is great. But still, it feels like a really good PS5 exclusive. It is PS5 exclusive, but it feels like a first-party showcase. And that, coupled with how well it runs, like, you know, butter-smooth frame rate, etc. It's just really nice. Like, I did a tweet just saying how much I was blown away by it. And I wasn't expecting that to take off so much, but I think a lot of people are curious about it. Like, a lot of people will have seen the marketing, like, you've seen the main character, you're curious if there's more to it, and then realizing that actually the fundamentals are Stellar Blade. And there's like a whole training area in the demo where you can fight an optional boss and you can get a taste for what harder combat's going to be like. I'm really impressed by it. And I thought I was done with Souls stuff. And I am, but like there's enough to this where like I'm actually looking forward to getting stuck in. And I guess I'll see what the difficulty curve feels like, because it feels a lot more manageable than your standard Souls game.
I'm really pleased to hear about the characterization and sort of the tone of the entire story, because when you make Nier comparisons, which like you said, a lot of the developers have made, saying they're inspired by that franchise, and Nier Automata especially. Like, Nier is more than just the look, it's more than just the combat, it's more than even just the story itself. It's about a vibe, right? It's about a sort of existential vibe that you get from juxtaposing those different elements of it. So I want that to remain for this, because like you said, the idea of having this sort of future world built over the remains of a previous one, that's so cool. And that has so much, I don't know, potential to comment on humanity's repeated mistakes or whatever it is. And I'm sure, I'm not saying I want like a stalker esque, you know, dense narrative from this, talking about the film there, but I'd like it if they are taking from Nier in more ways than just the combat, in more ways than just the overall look.
Yeah, thematically, there are some similarities. I'm going to keep it vague because people are going to go experience the story for themselves, but like, that whole idea of the portrayal of like a female body or something in Nier, like in Nier's case, in Nier Automata's case, seemed to be using it as a general comment on the idea of androids aping humanity. But then in real life, you had creator Yoko Taro just say he's just into really sexy looking women. I was like, okay, cool.
At least he's honest about it.
He's honest about it. And obviously Nier Automata, the character of 2B is like pretty iconic for her skirt being blown off.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like a whole look. Like entire figures you could buy like that. So I think it's going to be a similar thing in Stellar Blade where the fundamentals are solid. And I think that's going to be a whole discourse for the rest of the year of that idea of trying to look to the worthwhile components. Not that something being sexually attractive isn't worthwhile, obviously, but there's a whole side of the game that can stand alone without it needing to be sold on TNA.
I think it was it Gene Park who tweeted out the other day where he was like, there's been too much discourse around games this year. Every every game, no matter how innocuous it may seem.
Oh, it needs to be a full-on thesis. Yeah,
absolutely crazy. And I feel like, yeah, Stellar Blade hopefully won't be another one of those. But after Dragon's Dogma 2 and how wrong I was about that and its microtransactions, I just don't know anymore. I can't trust my own instincts because every big game comes with absolutely an insane amount of intensity.
Yeah, and I think that's, as a wider conversation, is interesting because you want the art that you consume to be as worthwhile as your intellect going in or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it's super easy to be like, I mean, I love a whole variety of different things, but I think it's super easy to get lost in that and be like, oh, is this actually worth my time? Is this actually pandering to like an older, more outdated version of myself or whatever it is? And when something is so overtly sexual like Stellar Blade, then it obviously gets caught up in that discourse and it's unavoidable. Like the devs have completely stayed into it.
Yeah.
It's not like the game doesn't have jiggle physics. But look, I was a Dead or Alive 2 fan myself. And so, like I said, I think that stuff is all present and correct, but it doesn't overshadow the fundamentals. It doesn't overshadow the combat, the unlocks, the progression, etc. So thankfully, it's a full package, no pun intended.
Very, very good.
Thank you.
I'm pleased it's demoing well. Mm. I'm pleased to see everyone turning their heads if they were naysayers and saying it's the real deal. I just hope that it can sustain that momentum across an entire big game. You know what I mean? Because it feels like this thing is going to be chunky. It feels like we're going to be spending tens of hours into it, probably. And after the year we've had where there have been so many huge, great games already released, like I said, Dragon's Dogma 2 and Rise of the Ronin just last month, Final Fantasy before then. There's a lot of competition.
Yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned it being this PlayStation 5 showcase. And I think Sony, in a way, have been very suave in their second-party relationships this year. You know, they've not had much, and they haven't got anything really announced from the first-party studios for this year. It's looking like Wolverine won't be ready until 2025. But they've relied really well on these second-party relationships. Like I said, Final Fantasy VII, Stellar Blade now, which is getting all of these plaudits and this buzz pre-release. And I'm just fascinated to see whether people come out of this year saying, that was a good year for PlayStation. It'll all be based on this outside the first-party ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Well, second and third-party have bailed out console manufacturers for as long as time, but at the same time, something like Stellar Blade, it's so immediately visually impressive. Like, it's so stylistic and cinematic when you're in combat. Like, it's easy to be wowed by it. That's why I kind of thought of the whole PS5 powerhouse thing, and then, you know, you take a minute and you realize that the rain is coming through in the controller, and there are really unique DualSense features to it, which, like, things like that, you want a game to show off what the console can do. I think Sony themselves have kind of failed at doing that. or not done it as consistently as they could have, let's say. So when something like this comes along that is ostensibly an out of nowhere, like we've seen it for a little while, it's been, you know, in trailers and stuff, but then getting hands on with it and it does seem promising. And hopefully, as long as they don't whiff the launch day, like in theory, the performance at launch shouldn't be worse than the vertical slice demo they've given us.
Yeah.
So for once, you'd actually get a technically impressive game at launch, which in the current era is like hardly ever the case.
Hey, it's absolutely true. And I'm kind of not holding my breath because again, Dragon's Dogma 2, a game I absolutely love, with performance issues out the ass. And that has been the case for a lot of big titles over the past few years. Again, Jedi Survivor, a game I loved, performance issues out the wazoo.
Yep.
Unforgivable in many regards. And I think it was John Linneman from Digital Foundry who was saying before release, Stellar Blade was a bit worrying in terms of how choppy it maybe looked. Can it really match the performance that a game like that needed? But everyone coming out the demo is like, this thing is rock solid.
Yeah, which you'd hope isn't like a deceitful thing. But yeah, apparently the demo that a lot of press were given access to was an older build or something, the one that's gone to the public.
Right.
Something like that, where there's a disparity between what people got hands-on with on the press side versus the public. And you would just hope that they haven't been polishing up a vertical slice separately. I just hope that it works out. Like, there's a lot of cool stuff here. I love a new dev making their mark, and there's a lot of confidence with this thing, so hopefully it comes through. Didn't even think I said at the beginning of the podcast that we'd be doing various news stories. Think we just sort of dove in.
Well, maybe we'll put it in the description, then we won't even have to re-record anything. Don't worry about it.
We'll see how it goes.
I still love the idea, man, that your child's first game, maybe Stellar Blade. There's something beautiful about that.
I can't not quote Al Pacino in Heat and assume that my kid will be saying, that's a great ass! And then good, going about good. Their day. Next news item down, Game Pass is apparently no longer as viable for developers as it used to be. This comes from PC Gamer, where creators of Slay the Spire and Darkest Dungeon were speaking to various developers coming out of the Game Developer Conference 2024. Slay the Spire's Casey Yano said in regards to Game Pass and Epic Store deals, I talked to at least five small teams, like 35 members and under, and they're like, cuts, 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 funding cancelled, talks that were going on for a year, cancelled. It sounds like it's S-word. We're definitely very privileged to be able to self-fund, otherwise I'd be very, very, very scared right now. He says the deals have come down, way down. Darkest Dungeons' Chris Bourassa said the gold rush is over. I come from the Northwest Territories. He's actually from Canada. The town I'm from was built on gold, and then they all found diamonds further north. Maybe another paradigm shift is waiting for us, but I definitely think the scale of the deals I'm hearing about is significantly diminished from the big swinging days. We got our Epic deal at the right time. So obviously Epic and Game Pass being brought in at the same time, but I think there's so much conversation on the idea of monthly monetization models, monthly revenue models. And I wanted to throw in that it was only September last year where Phil Spencer said if Game Pass revenue doesn't meaningfully improve by 2027, that Xbox will be getting out of the games industry. And even last week, we did a news video, me, Stevie, and Side did a video on the stuff that Phil Spencer was talking about and the general state of Xbox sales and things like that. It's I'm not going to pronounce it one way or the other, but it's like every week there's something else about the Xbox side of the general way they're approaching games that it just doesn't feel like it makes sense. Last week it was all the games are what matters, and that's what they don't have, and Xbox sales apparently not being very good across Europe.
They are in a strange situation right now, and it's a shame because, you know, we've always said that Game Pass is like one of the best deals in gaming, if not the best deal in gaming, for what you can get on that service and the amount of support that it has from the first party developers once they actually start releasing things. But I think it was always a case of that is only going to last for a certain amount of time. You know, we always criticize, or at least I always criticize, WB for being about 5 years behind the rest of the gaming industry. For whatever reason, it seems to me at least that it's a bunch of film executives primarily coming into the gaming mistakes. The gaming industry and making the mistakes that the rest of the gaming industry have already made. With Game Pass and other streaming services on consoles and PC, I think we're finally starting to see them make the mistakes that the movie streamers always did. Like, Game Pass, if this is correct, is going the exact same way that Netflix did. When Netflix first hit the scene, it made its name with original programming. It set itself out from any of the competition at the time and kind of got a monopoly at the time because Netflix original meant something.
Yes.
Netflix was greenlighting projects that Hollywood, in its conventional stuck-in ways, would never greenlight. They were given $200 million so Martin Scorsese could make
say The Irishman.
The Irishman, you know, where a studio like Paramount would have balked at that. And we got so many of these projects where Netflix was just throwing money in everything. It was like, give us stuff, give us content to put on our platform, give us stuff that Hollywood won't make. We'll fund it. We are a haven for filmmakers.
Just turn heads, make sure people know the name,
Get us subscribers, get us out there, make us some stuff. But then eventually, it turns out that as much as I love movies like The Irishman, spending $200 million on 10 of those a year is not a sustainable business model, especially when you don't have ads, or at least they didn't have at the time, and you rely on new subscribers and stuff. So where Netflix was once this haven for both these big movies and these movie directors who maybe fell out of the mainstream in Hollywood, and also great original TV shows and stuff like that. You know, how many shows did Netflix save that were canceled and brought them over and gave them a second lease of life? That was great for a bit. And then suddenly, when the growth stopped as much as they wanted it to continue, we saw all of the shows start to get cancelled. We saw them cut ties with a lot of filmmakers. They instead started relying on the same people that Hollywood was relying on, like Ryan Reynolds and Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And to me, that's exactly what this indicates from Microsoft. We've had that golden period where every first-party game, no matter what, if it's Halo or Gears, will be on there day one, where helping fund stuff like, or at least we're giving a platform to stuff like Immortality or Hollow Knight Silksong. This is a place for the big tier developers and the small tier developers. That, again, was something that could only last for a while. And now, to cut costs and make sure growth continues, we're greenlighting fewer things. Maybe we're going to think about what's on Game Pass and what we're putting on PlayStation, you know? It feels like it's going the same way that Netflix did.
No, man, I totally agree. I think, for me, there's such a massive issue with Xbox marketing. I feel like no one ever has any positive words to say about Xbox overtly, or didn't think about Xbox in a positive way overtly, because their footprint is just barely present. Like, we talked about Stellar Blade just before, and I feel like that is in front of YouTube videos. It's like the trailers are out there. It was part of Sony showcases. Like, the Xbox side of things, maybe it's because they don't have that many games to scream about. However, a good comparison would be when they showed off the Indiana Jones game, and for like a couple of weeks following that, you got people talking about the games again. It's never really been anything other than just make good games and people will buy them, or make notable games and people will at least talk about them. And I think in the pursuit of just having this monthly catalog of titles that gets uploaded, it never really feels like that remotely lived up to the same like excitement or, oh my god, like even something like, and maybe this is too personal of an example, Spotify's release radar every Friday. I get more excited for that than I do for Game Pass resetting every month. And it's not that there aren't worthwhile titles in there. Like, you know, you've loved Immortality a couple of years ago. Open Roads is awesome being on there. That's a new game.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, like reviewing fairly enough. But in general, I think they have such a massive marketing issue where they just don't get out there and talk about anything. And I think there's that assumption that they just fall back on like, well, Game Pass is omnipresent. It's included in certain TV deals. You get certain months of Game Pass with certain products or purchases or whatever that we don't need to get out there and do an overall exciting advert for it. But like I said, with something like Indiana Jones or whatever, at least you got people talking about titles again. And Starfield, like the tail on that's obviously been quite sour. People have dropped off it. But I feel like back in September when Starfield came out, I forget which member of Microsoft or Xbox was talking about that this is the starting pistol for Game Pass. This is the starting pistol for that regular cadence of titles. And maybe they'll eventually get there. But it's been so many, we've had so many versions of that now.
Yeah.
And those past promises of like, oh, we'll have an exclusive every month, or we'll have something every couple of months. And it's not that I don't enjoy what I've got. I'm paying for it as much as everybody else is. But I think because we're all paying for it and kind of going like, okay, is this it? Is this the culmination of your plan? Because it doesn't feel like it.
And you know what? Even Phil Spencer admitted a few years ago at this point that initial promise to get a big release out every couple of months, they never lived up to it. And hopefully this year will be the year once it gets rolling with Indiana Jones, with Avowed, with Hellblade, and hopefully a few more. It might be too little too late, because at this point I think people kind of know what Game Pass is, and they don't really make an effort to advertise it in the way you'd want them to. Of course there are adverts, of course there are announcements about which games are coming next month, but you know, I know that I maybe like the PlayStation Plus service more than you do. I think that's probably just as good as Game Pass for me personally. Right. But I think one edge that Sony has over Microsoft is making a big song and dance every month when they add new titles to it. Like, I don't have to go out of my way to find out what's being added to PlayStation Plus. It just gets served up to me in a blog post, admittedly. But it's something, it makes it feel like a bigger deal. Same with the monthly games, whereas games with gold, and if that even is a thing anymore, you know, it's hard to keep track. The monthly games on Xbox, it feels like there's less fanfare. And when there's not enough high-profile games attached to those monthly drops anyway, it makes them feel more forgettable. Like, I never know what's coming to Game Pass. Like,
same.
You reminded me of Open Roads. I completely forgot that was out there.
Well, because they didn't do any marketing for it.
Absolutely. And, you know, they put great games on there over the past few months alone. You know, they had Remnant 2 on there over Christmas. All of these titles that makes it an appealing venture if you want it, but it just feels like more of an afterthought than ever. But as we were saying, Game Pass rules, and it can be amazing when it's amazing.
Yeah, and it's like, I feel like they've had those wins that permeated like the general awareness of your average gamer, let's say. Like when they added GTA 5, it was a big talking point that they were getting GTA 5 for a few weeks or a few months. Red Dead 2 being on there was a big deal.
Yes.
It was even like talked about when it got taken off Game Pass again, like these big seismic titles that you can just get for free. One, I think they have an issue with letting people know what's coming to Game Pass in a wider sense. I always feel like I see people saying, I just bought this and now it's added on Game Pass. I didn't know that was about to happen. And I get that they can't advertise that too overtly, because then you just wouldn't buy a game because you'd be waiting for it to go on Game Pass.
Yeah.
Even if it was just title specific. But I do think that's part of it. And just overall, I feel like I said, if they're going to hang the entire business on this, like to talk about the indie side of it, where you've got the specific devs from Darkest Dungeon and Slay the Spire, maybe it literally is the model that you said, where it was just, let's turn as many heads as possible. But you're not really going to turn mainstream heads with a bunch of indie deals. And it, in theory, it never really made sense that you were spending this much money on these bigger deals. I mean, some of the examples given here could be more to do with the Epic Store, which is in a similar place, especially in regards to how we talk about it. But that idea of just like splurging all the cash, everyone's on Game Pass, get it all on here. And then it's the bigger titles where everything's fallen down again. All the studios are acquired. You know, we were waiting forever for Starfield to be on there. And then when Starfield dropped on there, it wasn't amongst a bunch of bigger indie hitters. It's not like Game Pass has had a stellar month. Like, it's maybe one title that you're glad you're getting for free, but that's about it. You don't really look at it overall and be like, oh my God, there's seven things I want to play.
No, that's true, but I think, I don't know, it's such a multifaceted thing. For me, the biggest word right now in the gaming space and kind of the modern media space is retention. Like, that matters so much to these major companies who, want to sell a lot of games, but would prefer you to keep playing them and buying into the ecosystem as much as possible. And I think that goes doubly when a business relies on, or at least is trying to shift into and prioritize streaming services, because those indie games, like you said, you know, they're not turning mainstream heads, but if they're enough to get people to continue subscribing for another month, I think they've kind of done their job in a way, because like you said, if I am jumping into Game Pass and there is one game I want to play, like, what they need to do is to give me a reason to just roll over that subscription and not think about it. And if there are a handful of titles, even if they're smaller, that I'm looking forward to in February after I've subscribed in January, that's amazing. And then I think the business model, at least initially and in theory, was we'll make all of these deals with everyone. We'll get games like Hollow Knight on the platform that have a more hardcore appeal. And then again, theoretically, we'll have a big first-party game that does turn heads every 3 or 4 months. And then we'll get new subscribers from them, and we'll be retaining the old subscribers from these guys. But that obviously hasn't worked out, because even more so than movies and television, video game production is so volatile, and you can't guarantee a constant churn of, and I hate to use the term, content like you can with TV shows. And even couldn't really do it with TV shows. We tried, we looked at Marvel, you know, or Star Wars, trying to do that exact same model in a quote-unquote easier production industry. And even they're the quality, you know, nosedive. People got fed up because they were just churning stuff out to try to keep that retention on their services.
To that end as well, that idea of the deals being made and trying to supply, for me, it's like, were they trying to supplant the gap in the release schedule and trying to do as many indie deals as possible, make them really lucrative, get as many different games on the platform as possible, as many different creators talking about Game Pass as much as possible, hence the whole it's the best deal in gaming side of it that came from that. And now that you have Indiana Jones, Hellblade 2, Avowed, etc., like, assumedly all the other games that have been in production are about to drop as well, whether that's from Undead Labs or Double Fine or the rest of, you know, Activision Blizzard, etc., maybe that supplants the way that the model has been so far, and they don't quote unquote need those indie titles as much because they're about to hit their cadence. I'm trying to do the other side of the coin. And are they about to finally nail the thing that they set in motion when Game Pass was first mentioned as being this steady rollout of head turning games?
There's two things for you here. First, to me, the idea of a gaming streaming service almost seems antithetical to what the gaming industry wants. Right. A streaming service is about giving you a bunch of new titles every month, or at the very least, access to hundreds of titles that you can jump into whenever you want. You know, you can watch an episode of Friends, you can watch an episode of Heroes if you want, if you hate yourself that much and you want to go watch season four of Heroes.
Really,
and that's kind of like what the gaming industry has mimicked. You can go on and play Brothers in Arms, if you want. You can jump into Midnight Fight Express, you can play Immortality, or you can play Halo Infinite. But is that antithetical to where the industry as a whole is going, where they want to make fewer games, but ones that you just pump your entire life into? You know, these live services that you're expected to log in, you know, day after day, do those dailies, get the new DLC, buy the season pass, get the battle pass, and constantly live on, right? Like, you can have those games, I guess, on these services, but what do these publishers actually want? In what's the most ideal revenue stream in their eyes? Is it a fewer games that, you know, you spend more time on, or is it a access to a huge library? Like, what makes more sense? Like, I like access to a huge library. That's right. What I would pivot towards, because I think it's insane, frankly, to make a industry rely on a few major blockbusters and to the expense of everything else.
Oh, yeah.
But that seems to be what those big publishers are prioritizing right now.
Well, it's like, in theory, Game Pass will be the answer to the constant live service push, because you could do, Open Roads isn't a very long game, from what I've heard. You could do a series of small single player titles with really good gameplay or really good story hooks, and they're part of the subscription anyway, and that all makes sense on the consumer side, because you're not spending £70 for a story game and then finishing it in a weekend. So in theory, Game Pass is the answer to all that stuff. But for me, one of the main issues is marketing. Like, if we talk about Phil Spencer saying he wants more of their bottom line being made up of Game Pass overall and more subscription numbers, you need to make Game Pass way more enticing. And potentially it will be by this time next year. But they're in such a weird place.
Scott, because you said, like, are they sacking off some of the indie games or focus on those smaller titles because they're about to get into this big rollout of first party games?
Because they bought so many studios, so many chickens, they're about to finally all produce.
Apparently about to pop out a bunch of eggs. But my question is, if they're thinking about growth, you know, Phil Spencer was talking about the capitalistic paradox of constant growth and how that limits him. Like, to me, I'm not looking at them and thinking they're going to go all in on Game Pass because they're going to give you a bunch of free stuff.
Right.
I'm thinking they're looking at their first party lineup, looking at how high they need to get the graph and going, should we just sell some of these? Should we just sell some of these at full price and not put them on Game Pass day one? Like, to me, genuinely, if we're following the Netflix way, I can see them pivoting into that. Maybe not right now, but, you know, with games already going multi-platform, will we get to a point where they just say, look, this model is simply not sustainable to make AAA first-party games and release them on Game Pass day one? They'll come to Game Pass eventually, but we need to sell some copies.
The other side of that would be what Sony were, in theory, going to do. Like, Sony's side was greenlight 12 live service games and then just have them all out there at once, a whole bunch of revenue streams. They're all taking over. Everyone's happy. Like, 12 Helldivers, Jeremy, do as many of them. I wonder if the Xbox side of that, if you go down the most like negative version of it possible, is you take the, I think it's over 40 million or whatever it is, subscribers to Game Pass, and you make the majority of games on that service live service. If live service as a model was more welcome, then you can see the dollar signs in the executives' heads if that was the way forward. I still think the average consumer doesn't care about live service stuff and is rejecting live service models. It's the likes of Helldivers that punches through, whereas Foam Stars is dead and largely buried itself at this point.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I feel like you even saw Microsoft flirting with similar ideas a few years ago. You know, for instance, making Halo Infinite's multiplayer free to play. You know, you didn't need to buy the campaign with that game. Hey ho, you've got a Halo live service that the entire Xbox ecosystem can jump into. Obviously, didn't pan out how Microsoft the 343 probably wanted, but if maybe that was a better game with better long-term support, it might have taken off. It might have proven that is, you know, viable. I just think with the moves they've been making, the way, the kind of doom that Phil Spencer has been approaching this year with, I guess, since the acquisition of Activision Blizzard King, I wonder about the future and what shifts they're going to make. You know, they've already had all of these layoffs. They've already had games go multi-platform. And I look at something like Sea of Thieves being top of the PlayStation Store, and I think they're going to see that money and go, yeah, okay, we'll continue maybe releasing these AAA games on Game Pass, but you can buy them for £70 on PlayStation if you want. We're not going to ignore that part of the market. We want the graph to go up. Might as well get that money.
Well, that is like the wider Xbox brand thing, where it's just an Xbox. They become the next Sega, where it's just the Xbox has a logo in front of a game that you play, but also that affects the viability of the interest in Xbox as a console manufacturer, because it's like, well, I might as well just hang back and these games will be on PlayStation later. They'll all be, if you bring in the wider feel of what it's like in modern gaming, they'll be patched, they'll probably have more Game of the Year type content, etc. So for me, most of that stuff works against Xbox.
Yeah.
Like, it definitely works for the bottom line, but it doesn't make them enticing as a platform, as a service, etc. Like, things like Sea of Thieves, Grounded or whatever, coming across to different platforms, Hi-Fi Rush, you might as well have just waited.
I know you're right. You're absolutely spot on. I guess. I just think if I'm Phil Spencer, which I'm not, Microsoft would be in the negative money by now. The entire company as well, not just Xbox.
No, just bring it all down.
Everything gone. I would be optimistic, right, about my games. I'd be assuming we're making the best games ever. And I think if you're working on the assumption that the likes of 343 or Obsidian or whoever it is are making 9 out of 10 games, 10 out of 10 games, Bethesda or whoever it is, then you could say that the incentive would be to have something as big as a Spider-Man 2, for instance, on Xbox. And I guess they could say that the incentive is, one, it's free, quote unquote, on Game Pass if you want to buy into our ecosystem, but also you're going to get it early. You're going to get it 6 months early, 12 months early before it even comes to PlayStation, where you have to pay a premium price on it. And yeah, me and you can sit here and go, people can wait, but at the same time, the kind of sales of games shows that the majority don't wait, myself included, to a certain degree. Like, the first weekend or the first couple of weekends are often the most important in a game's life, whether it's deemed a success or not. So it's like, yeah, of course, a lot of people will happily go, I'm not going to buy an Xbox just to play this game if it's coming here in 12 months. But, you know, timed exclusivity works for a reason.
Well, they saw a huge spike in console sales when Starfield came out.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, which is always, I mean, it's all, the whole thing, it's like, it should and it shouldn't be more simple than it's always the games. I just feel like it always just comes back around to that. Like, that's why we got into the industry in the first place. Like, me and you literally, in regards to sitting here talking about it, but it's why people cared about the industry. Like, it's why you care about it as an art form. Like, you can have as many different delivery methods and models as you want that serve different corporate masters on a longer timeline.
Yeah.
And then they all get to retire with lovely packages and everything, but it's going to be the games. It's always the games. It always has been. And if you haven't got them, it's going to fall apart.
Oh, and this is why I'm cynical, despite being optimistic about Xbox as a company for the past few years, because it is all about the games. And again, in our utopia that we created, we always said Microsoft has unlimited coffers. They've got resources out the wazoo. They theoretically could buy up all of these studios and make them better. Give Obsidian the resources they need to not have to crunch a New Vegas out in 18 months or whatever it is they were given for that game. They could maybe help alleviate the crunch happening at Activision with Call of Duty, you know, give that franchise a more sustainable model that is better for gamers, it's better for the developers, it's better for the industry as a whole. But I think that utopian dream is dying again because Phil is saying, you know, we need constant growth. We're making all of these layoffs, and then people are saying about Game Pass that the golden goose is no longer there. And it's like, you know, they've made a $70 billion acquisition, and now I worry they've got themselves into a hole, and now we're going, we need to dig our way out of it. How do we dig our way out of it? And unfortunately, to these executives, the answer is never, well, give us a variety of games. Let the developers do whatever they want. It's like, no, we need to maximize this IP. We need to make as much profit as possible. And I worry they've gone too far in their spend.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
To be able to even justify creating interesting standalone games and not focus on those handful of big hitters from these studios that I hope get more freedom under Xbox.
I'm very curious what Game Pass looks like by this time next year. Because I do, if they manage to maintain the cadence, then you will have Hellblade, Avowed, whatever else on Game Pass. And this time next year, we might think of Game Pass as being a more, big first party, higher production budget on average service. And that would work better for a mainstream response to that service, and then maybe you see them get behind their marketing, because I guess at the minute, what are they going to put the marketing behind? They did a lot of it for Starfield, and you felt that, you saw it be more active, which is what I'm trying to get at with the whole marketing problem, but maybe that's why they haven't marketed Game Pass overall, because they don't have a selection of things yet. But whereas when you can make those highlight reels and sizzle reels and go, you're getting all this for one monthly fee, they can lean on that and then throw the Call of Duty stuff in, everything else, and try and nail it. Next thing down, Tekken 8 is getting a battle pass, my friend. And this is after it just got a microtransaction exclusive in-game store, and it already has a season pass for its upcoming characters. It's called the Tekken Fight Pass, and it's the game's battle pass. And according to Namco, during a specified period, players can increase their level by completing daily and weekly missions in online matches, allowing them to obtain various items. However, they haven't said if it lets you get the premium items, because in the store that they put online, the Tekken Shop, all that stuff is microtransaction only. Although in the game, you can earn millions of gold coins. You can't spend them on the premium items. You can't even exchange. There's no exchange rate, nothing like that. If you want Jin Kazama's Tekken 4 sweat, the hoodie, which I do every day.
The best Tekken.
I don't know about that, but it's close to Tekken 5. You've got to cough up the real cash for it. And obviously that in itself drew quite a lot of ire from the community, including myself. Tekken 8 is game of the year. And that whole thing being like, is there not going to be an exchange rate for this? Is there no way for us to just play the game and afford the real premium stuff, like in Helldivers 2 or something? Maybe the Battle Pass is an answer to that. But it's just worth flagging that idea of releasing a game. The reviews are sky high. It's a very, very solid title. And then you start plugging the microtransactions in, you plug the battle pass in. They did advertise the season pass from day one. Eddie Gordo is the first character. He's coming soon. And it's just that conversation on it. I did see Kazuhiro Harada, like obviously Tekken's godfather, out there on Twitter just saying, look, game development has changed. We need these additional monetization elements to make sure the devs get paid long term. I get that. And I saw with Tekken 7, that was the first time they really steered into that stuff. With the various the character season passes, and they extended it, and they had Noctis from Final Fantasy 15 and Negan from The Walking Dead. But I just think it's interesting. It's one of those things that you want to check studios on, because if they don't get checked, then maybe this is always the case. And maybe that's fine. Maybe the consumer responds to this positively. I doubt it. At the minute, it's very, very sour around Tekken 8, because you're trying to release the game very positively and then plug in these other microtransactions and monetizable elements to it. And it's annoying, because I love Tekken 8. I think it's absolutely flawless, and I recommend it to everybody. And it's a weird mind F being like, well, I do want to see what these items are.
Yeah.
And I do want to do the dailies and the weeklies, but I'm just too aware of the potentially predatory economy that goes around it, where you have a premium item store that I'm already fighting myself to not buy the premium skins and stuff like that. And I just wonder, is this a default going forward for someone like Namco, or for something like Tekken?
I feel like it is. Tekken 8, for as much as probably we don't want to admit it, is kind of a live service. It's a multiplayer game. I know it's got a story and a bunch of arcade modes as well, but like its longevity is built around the multiplayer, right? It's built around adding new characters, adding new seasons, adding battle passes that extend the length of it. And I hate that I've become a microtransaction defender. This is absolutely not the case at all. But when I saw this from the outside, I just thought, yeah, that makes sense. That sounds about right for a fighting game to have a battle pass for its characters, for it to release characters with as DLC to continue the tale of it over these seasons. But I don't know how predatory it might be. I don't know what the pricing model is, and I don't know how coy they were with this pre-release. You know, my only point of comparison...
These two things didn't exist then. Yeah.
Right, yeah. My only comparison is something like Call of Duty... Modern Warfare, right? Or any Call of Duty game where they always say, like, look, we're going to release this game at launch, and then with season one, about 4 weeks afterwards, that's when we'll introduce the first battle pass and stuff. And I'm like, all right, at least you've told me I don't have to pay into that. I can still buy some of the premium things with the currency that I earn in game. So I think there's a way to do a battle pass, but if they weren't upfront about that, and if they were a bit cagey about the fact that a lot of the progression was going to be tied to a battle pass, then that absolutely sucks.
So that's where we're at the minute, like the only thing that people knew about when they bought in was the season pass, where it was, I think it's four characters in the first season pass. And Eddie Gordo was the first one, like I said. The battle pass and the Tekken shop were two things that weren't mentioned, as far as I know, before launch, and they seem to have been added afterwards. Also, the big part of this, big potential variable here is the entry fee, is the price point. This is a premium priced product. We'll talk about Suicide Squad later on, but like that idea of, which is becoming the norm, of like charge 70 or charge a premium entry fee and then monetize the people who paid that anyway with no real and from the dev side, I'd be fascinated, does the consumer even deserve compensation because they did buy in at your premium price point for what is now a free-to-play model in theory? Like if you take that idea of Tekken becoming a live service, a free-to-play, which Tekken has done, Tekken Revolution I think was the free-to-play one that was just rejected by the Tekken Massive back in like 2010 or whatever, that idea of monetizing the tale of Tekken 8, where you've got the shop and you've got the microtransaction side of it and you've got the battle pass, that like is a free-to-play model. But you have people who have bought in, paid £70, $70, and they don't have any premium currency to then spend. There's no goodwill. Thanks for getting us there.
Yes.
There's not that.
That's what I was going to ask, because again, Call of Duty is not the best model for this. Please, studios, don't copy Call of Duty. Like they have made some mistakes. They have certainly made a lot of monetization mistakes, but at least they... with their seasonal content. Like, you know that while you might have to pay a premium currency for a specific skin or some items in the battle pass, you at least know that all the weapons are going to be free and all the maps are going to be free. So as a longtime player who might have bought the base game, you don't have, quote-unquote, have to spend anything to at least keep up with the player base. Whereas here, it does seem, and correct me if I'm wrong, like everything is gated behind some barrier, like the characters are gated behind a character, some of the costumes are, and I guess the items are. Like, what do you get? Do you get anything for free?
No, you do. That's the thing. If I was being Tekken lawyer and defending it, like, yes, there is £70, $70 worth of content here for that price.
Yeah.
Like, you have the full story mode, even though it's not very long, but you do have a cinematic story mode. There's the arcade quest, which is like a parallel story mode thing where you're learning how to play Tekken. You play as a different character that's like a mimicked after yourself kind of thing. There is like the base multiplayer. You can do all the rankings. You can do all that stuff. Like, there is a full Tekken game here. It's the way that they're monetizing this stuff afterwards. And I think the main issue is communication, that it wasn't mentioned earlier, because it makes you feel like, as someone who champions this game and absolutely loves it, I think Tekken 8 is phenomenal. It's just a bit of a weird beat where it's like, oh, are you bolting this on because you got positive reviews?
Yeah.
Are you bolting this on because you got a really positive reception? And how far are we going to go with this? And is this a pivot towards an entirely free-to-play Tekken again? Like, I doubt it, because they might as well do both. They're double dipping right now.
So let me get this straight. I just need to be fully... I have full clarity before I go in on it, because I'm coming in as someone who's looking out of this. Didn't even know this was happening until right. the biggest Tekken fan in the world, Scott Tilford, talked to me about it.
Tekken Tilford's name of my
is
child.
Eddie Gordo in the season one characters, is that behind a paid season pass?
Yes.
And then there is a paid battle pass that's part of that, or is it on top of
They're
that?
Separate. So,
and then you've got the store as well.
Yes.
That sucks, man. That absolutely sucks. Like, I wouldn't even defend it, I don't think, if right. you got, say, the characters for free. But it would be something. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you know, yeah, you're paying $70 or whatever it is for the core game, and you're getting that, you know, all those bloody features within it, the story mode, the arcade, the online, and everything. Mm-hmm. But, like, to fracture the player base to such a degree with the post-launch content and say, well, if you want to continue keeping up to date and you want to keep playing, you got to spend some money at the very least. That absolutely sucks, in my
I think that you'll still have the multiplayer will still be online. It's just that you'll see Eddie Gordo populating that online. Yeah. And it's like, because the season pass, because it's separate. Like you said, season pass, battle pass, two separate things. The battle pass is the thing that's coming soon, but that doesn't have a price tag on it yet. Season pass is what's been there since day one, but they haven't started adding anything to it yet. But the season pass is about £30 or $30. It's an upgrade from the standard version of the game, which is in itself £60-70 anyway. It's a premium price point. Like I said, I think that there's enough there for that £60-70 price point. Like, I love Tekken 8.
Yeah.
But you see them monetize the hell out of one of the most dogged fan bases in gaming history.
Dude.
And it's worth checking them on it.
Personally, I think it's criminal to choose both rather than one.
Right.
Like, if you made me pay for $30 for a season pass, and I'm going to get four or five new fighters, and they're going to come with their own unique movesets, and you're going to have a plethora of unlocks for each one. All right, that's DLC as we've known it. Yeah. Same with if you're going to give those characters for free, and you're going to tie a battle pass to them for those new costumes. All right, it's not ideal, but at least I'm getting something. Mm-hmm. To do both, I think, is kind of outrageous.
I just think they're seeing what they can get away with, let's say. It feels like the kind of, like I said, the approach that would eventually become a free-to-play model, but they're not going to go fully free-to-play Tekken because that term is way too poisoned.
Yes.
And they might as well get the day one, you know, there's all the pre-order bonuses as well, but it's like you might as well pay that upfront money, bank those people, and then now we're like a month and a half-ish after launch, whatever it is. Mm. Maybe that number started to drop off a little bit. Okay, roll out the microtransactions, roll that stuff out.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be getting talked about right now if I wasn't talking about it as someone who is playing Tekken 8. Mm-hmm. And this happens all the time with various different games where you'll get different publishers, different teams seeing what they can get away with.
That's it. And that's honestly why I understood a lot of the ire. Not all of it, but you know, a lot of the ire with Dragon's Dogma 2 and that store just suddenly being there because, yeah, you feel sort of a bit swindled if you didn't know that was part of the game. And then suddenly it's like, oh, there's this whole part of it that even if it doesn't infringe on the gameplay itself, like I don't think it does in Dogma 2. Mm. It's like, well, what are you trying to get away with? Like, you know something's a bit dodgy, otherwise you've like, been very upfront with it. Like Crash Team Racing as well, when that just introduced the store after the fact, because it does exactly like what you said, where the reviews are out, and as someone who isn't in the Tekken ecosystem, I am thinking Tekken 8 is this 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 experience, one of the best fighting games in years. Everyone's raving about it, but if I were to buy it now, ooh, now there's a load of microtransactions and there's that's a season pass and a battle pass and a premium store.
And it's like when you buy, say you buy Tekken 8 now, you would get a whole bunch of pop-ups. It'll be it does that every time you boot it up anyway with things that are happening in the Tekken news feed. But that's such an awkward thing to navigate because I do still think it's phenomenal. And I do still think the bulk of the game, it's not free, but it's what you get with the price point to get you in the first place. And a lot of the Tekken shop isn't giving you pop-ups. It isn't even on the roster page. Like, you can see it in the character creator. It'll remind you of a costume you could buy. Otherwise, on the main menu, it's just a small Tekken shop icon. It's almost not the point. But the things to navigate, it's like you have to give all these caveats and be like, oh, but you can't enjoy it, really.
Yeah.
And it's just a bit of a shame that you'll get millions of Tekken fans having to now have these conversations of trying to meet out what's worthwhile, what's not. Okay, avoid that. Don't pay that. It'll probably go down soon. And the thing is, the game has a phenomenal character creator as well, which is one of the many memes and bits of coverage that happened around launch, was look how versatile this character creator is. There could be more to it, but it's very, very effective. I actually created Horang's Tekken 4 look in the character creator for free.
Nice.
Which is like potentially on the defensive side, where if you say like, oh, well, I wish I could make Jin's tracksuit or something, and then they go, well, it's £10 or it's $10.
Yes.
And like I said, at time of recording the Battle Pass, the Tekken 5 Pass doesn't have a price, so they could look at all the response to this and factor it into the season pass, but that's not how it was mentioned so far.
That's it. I need clarity on this. If you're going to announce something like this, you need to be as upfront as possible, right? Because like you said, if this was announced pre-launch, there might be a bunch of players who were like, hell yeah, I want a battle pass. I want some more progression after the fact, and I'm fine if it's not totally intrusive and I can earn some free stuff as well, having that style of progression. But the fact that they're like, yeah, there'll be a battle pass, but we're not going to really tell you what's in it. We're not really going to tell you how much it is or even necessarily when it's coming. Mm-hmm. That is... Yeah, it's not the one for me, especially in an industry where fighting games have already made similar mistakes. Like, how much did Mortal Kombat 1 drop off in part of how that game was monetized? And there's nothing that I hate more than when something has clearly been cleaved in half in terms of content and then sold to you later or drip-fed to you through these battle passes. Like, the lack of costumes, for instance, in Mortal Kombat 1, again, felt kind of criminal because I just knew that stuff is going to be coming post-launch or whatever, and I'm going to have to pay more for it when that stuff should be standard. And it's kind of a similar thing here where it's like, come on, I know people will pay for these outfits, but...
The thing is,
could it not have been included in there alongside the other options?
Yeah, or do a make good for those of us who paid full price on day one and can continue to support the franchise. The thing is, as well, on some of the skins that are the premium skins that are in the Tekken shop that are £10, $10, some of them are barely upscaled looks from Tekken 6, Tekken 7. Like, the graphics haven't changed that much, let's say, in the last couple of Tekken games. But that's the whole wider conversation on how much the average person will pay for a premium skin, which Call of Duty and Destiny have, including you, have completely changed the parameters of that stuff, which you spend your money on whatever the hell you want. But I do wonder, are we just too far gone with this stuff? And then a franchise does it that hasn't done it to this degree, and everyone goes, oh my God, you guys are doing it? And it's like, but on their side, they're like, well, everyone else is.
I know. I think, you know what, again, I don't want to defend Call of Duty. It does a bad thing a little bit better than this. Right. And that's kind of the point I'm trying to make, because again, Call of Duty is probably charged for skins from previous games before, but at the very least, when you have something new in the store or the battle pass, it's something completely different. It's something like the only skins I've ever paid for are the Ash Williams skin, for instance. So it's an Evil Dead crossover. You know, it's something silly. It's something that would never be in the main game. It's not selling me a iconic outfit for a character that I love or like the face of the franchise. Again, it might have done that with like Captain Price and stuff, but 9 times out of 10, that's not what the service is built around. As far as I'm aware, again, I'm almost making a lot of caveats for itself, but the stuff that I've always been interested in is like, all right, I get to play as Nicki Minaj. All right, I get to play as Snoop Dogg. All right, I get to play as Ash Williams. All right, I get to play as Timothy Chalamet in Dune 2. And I'm like, fair enough, that's separate enough.
Yeah.
You're not preying on my nostalgia necessarily. Keeping core franchise looks or features or unlocks out of the game to sell me it later, which it kind of sounds like the Tekken.
No, it is. I mean,
devs are doing
that. That Jin costume is like Tekken 4. It's iconic. It was on the box art. It is a specific look for Jin Kazama. I think it's a really thorny conversation, because I think in Tekken's case, Tekken 8 is still an immaculate body overall.
Yeah.
And I do want the devs to be paid long term. Obviously, like, I want them to be able to support the game and be happy doing it. So I see that side of it. But like I said, I think it's just worth checking them. I don't think there's a conclusion right now, other than, like you said, comparing it to other monetization models and looking at the season pass, the battle pass, the microtransaction store. They're just opening all of those up for now and just seeing how they go. And if the player numbers drop off, if the transactions aren't there, then maybe things get relaxed or whatever. And also the best part, well, one of the better outcomes of this would be that the new battle pass gives you the premium currency for the costumes. So there's some way to just play the game and buy the costumes without having to fork over the money.
They have to include that, surely. I don't know. It's come on. You've got to include, oh man. You've got to include some way to overtime get that stuff for free.
I think they've not released the numbers on it, but I think whether they do or don't will be based on how many people have bought the Tekken shop stuff so far. Because the Tekken store has been active for about a month or so.
Yeah.
Has the majority of players given in and bought the Jin skin for £10, $10? I haven't, because I refuse to. But I wonder if that's what the market's doing, then they'll just big business it, and that's where we are now.
I hate a lot about gaming. Even though I love a lot about it, I've loved some of the games we've had this year, you know, some all-timers, some incredible scenes, Tekken 8, before all this nonsense included, you know, outstanding games. But
Still is,
you know, the core experience, absolutely. But I hate that this industry hates its biggest fans.
Right.
I hate that the people who have connections with these franchises and who love them and are there day one through thick and thin are the ones who get exploited. And I've been in that case as well, where I've jumped into a game that a franchise that I've respected, it's a new entry, and I've been burned by it. And in this case, it's like, we're going to target the people almost who were there, you know, day one or the first month or the first week, spending $70 to buy our game, and then we're going to exploit their love of the franchise by selling them these iconic iconic looks after the fact. We're going to capitalize on the idea that they will love this franchise so much that they'll pay all of this extra money for iconic DLC characters and everything that comes with it. It's like, guys, man, you used to, at least in my naivete, used to obfuscate this stuff a little bit more. Right. You used to be less brazen about it, and now it's just like, you love us, you're going to pay.
And I definitely feel that impulse. I definitely feel that when I love Tekken 8 so much. I love these characters. I love this look. I would like to wear that skin. And then the other part of me that reinforces it or battles against it is I don't want to pay that. I'm not paying that money for a skin. I've never been someone who's going to pay £10 for a skin. How much fast food I can get for £10?
How about £16? Play Call of Duty with me, yeah?
I remember like all the stuff with when Destiny rolled it out and it was $40 for some custom dance emotes.
Oh, man.
There's been so many steps to get here.
Yeah.
And that was back in like 2016, 2017. So I feel like I'm one of the last holdouts to give into this stuff. And I refuse to do it. But like I said, you've got to check them. You've got to check the studios. You've got to get the word out there for people who aren't aware that this is the way that a certain game is being monetized. Because if the word gets loud enough, then there will be change. But like I said, I don't know how much the average person is giving into this stuff, and maybe it's already too late.
Maybe.
We'll have to see. Last news item down as we hit 1 hour recording is, did you know Suicide Squad's still dead? They found a way.
Bang, bang. What do you mean, Scott Tilford?
They found a way to make Suicide Squad even more dead. We need some sort of legal clarification for can you be buried more than Suicide Squad? I barely even knew that the game's Joker DLC was a thing. Yeah. It happened, but players are furious with the way that the game's Joker DLC is rolled out. He's locked behind grinding out between 10 and 20 repeat campaign missions of a 76-part battle pass, only for the character himself to have repetitive dialogue, the gameplay that isn't very differentiable from everybody else. The boss battles that you're doing are also reused from the main game, and that's after Brainiac himself is a pretty much a reskin of the Flash boss fight.
Yep.
So you're doing that over and over again to try and get a hold of Joker, and then Joker himself barely fits into the game. And also, like, once you finally unlock him, he pretty much plays the same way. Obviously, certain attacks are animated differently, but you're moving around the same way. Fans have noticed that he doesn't even address Harley. They don't have any dialogue between the two of them, which is a huge thing. The really insulting part, though, is that this grind, you can offset it by just buying Joker outright.
Amazing.
You can just pay, you can use 1,000 Luther coins, which are either £8 or $10 as a single microtransaction that gets you 1,100, and then you can use 1,000 just to buy Joker if you want. So if that grind does grind you down, you can pay your way out of the mine you've put yourself in. But I think that that's a horrible state for a video game to be in, where I don't even feel like there were that many people excited about Joker anyway, but then he's buried behind a very repetitive grind which mimics the grind of the end game, so the people who are already in there, who are maybe looking forward to new mission types or something like that, they're not going to happen. Apparently there's a mission type, I think it's called Incursion, that's been mentioned for a while, but it's not actually launched with the season pass.
Okay.
So there's mention of a new mission type, but it hasn't happened yet. But like I said, even if you do cough up the money or whatever, you don't get a meaningful version of Joker. One, he's like an Elseworlds Joker, so it's not the one that died, because they wouldn't get Mark Hamill back, and that would be an even bigger insult to everyone who's got to this point. But also, he doesn't address Harley, doesn't feel like it's a meaningful part of the game. The the cutscene that introduces him is apparently a motion comic, not actually a cutscene, just a more simple thing to put together, not to insult motion comic artists. I love them for the most part. And there's a cutscene towards the end of his stint as well, but what's going on?
I don't know what's going on, Scott. I think, to me, this vindicates my thought that this game might have the worst endgame of a live service I've maybe ever seen. Like, I was worried when I finished up my time with it, and spoilers, the game says fight 13 Brainiacs, but you have to wait for the DLC to fight some of those Brainiacs, and that's all you have to look forward to. All you got to look forward to from the promise of the first season are these new characters and the chance to fight a different version of Brainiac again and do the same missions you've already done again. You know, I could have maybe held out some optimism that these releases would add substantial story content that really made the game worth playing, made it feel complete, but it doesn't seem like that's the case at all. And there are a few issues here. One is the promise of that Brainiac boss fight. They've already detailed the first slew of these, and yeah, it's just a variation on the fight you've already had. You know, Brainiac taking on the powers of the Flash or Green Lantern or whoever it is, and the fight will be slightly different from the base version of those superheroes, but going off the end of the original game, not that much. And it's like, Why do I want to fight Brainiac Green Lantern? Why do I want to fight Brainiac Superman when I've already fought those? Like, do you not have anything else, any other supervillain I can fight, please? That isn't just a reskin of the fight that I've already had from a few hours ago. That, to me, is just crazy that that is the hook of these, I guess, kind of raid light missions that you're getting. But the second and maybe most pressing issue is exactly what you alluded to. You're getting these characters in, right? You're getting the Joker in.
Yeah.
But the issue, or one of the fundamental issues with Suicide Squad's gameplay, is that all the heroes play the same. They have slight variations, but they are incredibly slight. It usually just amounts to what melee weapon they have and what main guns they can use, or at least are proficient in. So what's the point in getting characters in this world if they're going to play the same? They're glorified skins, right? They're not characters in their own right. It doesn't sound like Joker's got too much story. Again,
no,
can't really criticize that because I've not played it, but in terms of the play styles, like, why would I be looking forward to anyone when I was bored of all four characters in the main game anyway?
Well, yeah.
Slightly different traversal mechanics, but nothing fundamentally different. It's not like you're adding in, I don't know, it's not like you're making Wonder Woman playable or anything, and you're moving away from guns and you're having a melee-based system. Even, I can't believe this game has me defending every time Marvel's Avengers, but even Marvel's Avengers, right, for the most part, brought in characters and gave them unique move sets. All right, some of them were crap and kind of similar to what was already in there. But at least Spider-Man could swing around and he could fire his webs. And yeah, he played similar, but at least it was slightly different.
Yeah.
Here, it's even less than the Avengers again.
I feel like on the story front as well, like I said, he doesn't acknowledge Harley. It doesn't really feel like it's a meaningful part of the squad. I think there is, like I said, there's a cutscene if you finish his missions, but it's very, very little. And that whole idea of it being part of the Arkhamverse is just so out the window now. Like, it is, it feels like it's just a marketing term. Like, it doesn't surprise me, or it surprises me even less in retrospect, that Rocksteady lost so many key creatives. Like, you had the founders of the studio leaving during the creation of Suicide Squad. And I wonder, like, how much of this longer Battle Pass stuff and the long-form tail monetizable side of it was part of the conversation for the last 10 years, or whether it's more of a new thing.
That's my question as well. I got a lot of questions about this game, but I thought when I hit credits on the main game, I was like, this was short. It's not finished. Like, it doesn't have a proper satisfy ending. It's built around the end game. So part of me was thinking, right, okay, maybe this is unsatisfying because they've maybe cleaved it in half. Maybe they have substantial story beats to come in the DLC. Maybe they're saving that stuff and kind of giving it to us later so they have a DLC roadmap that gets people invested. But to me, it's the worst of both worlds because it seems like, no, they don't have that. The DLC that's arriving is very slight, but also the main game isn't complete in and of itself. So it's like, I don't know what has happened from the developer and publisher side to result in this product after so many years. And again, try to clarify as much in this video as much as possible. Like, Rocksteady is such a talented studio. They've clearly got talented devs, even working on Suicide Squad. But who is making the decisions to have this end game and make the core game structured around that repetition and the lack of variety?
I wonder, like, yeah, speaking of Rocksteady, like, I have nothing but strong positive things to say about Rocksteady. They defined an entire, like, I'd say a wing of video games in regards to superhero video games. Like, Arkham Asylum, one of the most influential video games of all time, whether just its combat system or its overall production or the way that it treats its characters, etc. And then Arkham City, Arkham Knight. I just hope they're okay.
Yeah,
like,
no,
I wonder how much from the top down, from the Warner Brothers side down, because you do have Warner Brothers CEO or CEO David Zaslav talking about investing in live service, so wanting more of that stuff. How much of that is just forced upon this game now, even though the numbers aren't there? Like, even when it debuted, Mood. I think it was only like number 13 or something in the UK charts or whatever. It didn't do very well. It was in the digital PlayStation stores trending top 10 like for a couple of days on launch weekend. But I feel like the more people got hands on with it, the more they realized how repetitive it was. And I haven't actually gone through the game's trophy data to see if people have finished it. There's definitely a hardcore fandom here because you see them occasionally on social media. They're obviously the Reddit threads and things like that. And I just wonder, is that increasingly small pool of people now being monetized for the absolute, like to the nth degree?
Yeah.
Like what happened with the Avengers, because that game went offline. But in its dying throes, the Avengers was charging like £50 per skin, £150 for a skin pack, because you might as well monetize those players. And at some point, you just need to get out.
Yeah.
Like it's going to be a corporation monetizing a group of people for as much as until you tap out.
That's it, right? That's we just talked about this when we were discussing. I can't remember what we discussed. Scott, it was, feels like an hour ago.
We've been here for days.
We've been in here for days, but we were discussing microtransactions and Tekken 8 and yes. You know, them exploiting the fan base that they already have. And yeah, that's what I can see happening with Suicide Squad, because like you said, it happened with the Avengers. Mm-hmm. Suddenly the grind was elongated because Square Enix was saying, oh, people love grinding. We'll just make that arbitrarily longer so we get more
playtimers.
Retention. Yeah, yeah. No. And then they maybe will buy our Battle Pass and buy the new characters and buy the DLC. I look at Suicide Squad and it reminds me of Anthem, and yes. I expect to see some similar deranged decisions in its sort of dying throes to try to get as much money out of the remaining audience as possible. And that sucks for an IP as big as this and for a studio with such caliber behind it. Like I honestly wonder if all of the four content drops are even going to happen. And
that's
if,
what
and
I was
if they
say.
Do, I can't imagine anymore unless something radical happens with them and Rocksteady's allowed to make them these can't miss, you know, experiences. We've seen games turn it around, but based on what I've seen from Joker and based on the core game itself and how Warner Brothers is discussing it, I just don't know if they will be able to put the time and money and effort behind it in the same way that like a No Man's Sky turned things around.
No,
to
yeah.
me, it looks like an Avengers, it looks like an Anthem, and I wonder at what point does WB say it's not even worth keeping this going.
Well, that's the thing. I don't what's your dream scenario for turning this around? Like I because the thing is, I'm going to go into a little bit into data mine stuff here, because there are leaks for the game that have done the rounds talking about resurrecting the characters and doing the boss fights all over again, which kind of makes sense if you're trying to reheat the same stuff over and over again. You already have those game designs, you have those gameplay mechanics in place for those boss fights.
Yeah.
The next seasonal villain is apparently Mr. Freeze, so there's that. But like you said, if the comparison is, no, I don't necessarily compare it to No Man's Sky, but I can see that Cyberpunk and No Man's Sky feel like they're quite similar in terms of how much hate there was and how sort of mismarketed they were. Suicide Squad was marketed fairly straightforwardly and was what we thought it was.
Yeah.
But that idea of like, what could it possibly do to turn heads? You'd have to gut the whole thing.
You'd have to gut the whole thing. They would never do it. And it pains me to say it, because I love Harley Quinn and right. I love Harley Quinn in this game. I think she's like genuinely really funny, really well presented, really well acted. Like visually, like the detail, all the characters, to be fair, is really, really good. But for me, the answer would be sack off the Suicide Squad. Just sack them off.
Yes.
They don't play different enough.
Right.
Like they're boring to spend so much time with, because all you are doing is leveling up your guns. They could be anyone. They could be custom characters, and it would barely have an impact on the actual gameplay.
True.
Of course, it would radically change the story, but on the actual gameplay, it doesn't matter that you're playing as Captain Boomerang. It doesn't matter that you're playing as King Shark or Harley Quinn or I can't remember, Deadshot, I think it is. Always get him mixed up with Deathstroke.
Fair.
So I always mix that up. I don't even know if they're both DC, right?
I'm going to read my credentials now. Deathstroke is in the museum in this game.
That's
you can look at a mural of him.
That is right.
Yes.
But yeah, honestly, the way to save it is sack those guys off and make the playable characters actually different. You know, Wonder Woman in the game is, her scenes are amazing. And every time she's on screen, I was saying, why am I not playing that Wonder Woman game over there when she's fighting Superman around you and you're protecting a convoy, someone in a car, same mission type you've done 20 times. I'm like, but there's a good game happening over
there.
See
that giant King Shark that can eat people alive? Give him a gun.
Yeah. Just
give him some pistols.
Hey.
Don't worry about
give
it.
Give him a gun. That's just the answer to everything. And it's like, They would never do it. It's a completely different game. But if they were reviving the Justice League members, make them playable.
Yeah.
You know, I think give us something.
It's worth saying, like, I just hope Rocksteady are okay. I just hope they have something, some other irons in the fire, something else other than the majority of the people over at Rocksteady being bowled into this project that I have to imagine most of the people literally there are not enjoying their day today. I have no idea. Maybe they're loving it, and props to them. But I just want to know what they're doing next. I want to know if they're okay, because the project that was in the works, I forget what year it was cancelled internally, was a multiplayer shooter anyway.
Yeah.
And it always felt like the Suicide Squad wrapping was given to that multiplayer shooter. So in theory, Rocksteady's core identity as being this single player studio would have gone to the side anyway when this other project came together. But I'm just curious, is that why they wanted to take the studio? Like, there was a whole lot of disappointed people around Arkham Knight, which is fair enough. I was one of them. And I'm just curious, like, where do you go from there? You look at the trajectory from Arkham Asylum through Arkham City, Knight, and then this. And it's just like, your next step is the most important.
Yeah.
And I just hope that it's not straight down to face plant the floor.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I fully agree. I want them to, you know, come back from this in a big way, make something really special. Mm. I just hope that the WB executives have the patience and I guess the foresight to understand what talent they actually have on their hands, and not just, I don't even want to say it because it sounds like it, because it could genuinely happen, but start shutting down studios that they don't think are profitable. It sounds like they want to get out of the AAA business entirely, move into free-to-play and mobile games. And I'm like, but you have Rocksteady, you've got NetherRealm, you've got, I think it's Monolith Studios. Yep. All of these huge development teams that could be making excellent things and have made excellent things in the past. And it just feels like they're getting put through the corporate exec grinder to make as much a monetizable cashola as they possibly can.
There's also, just to round this out, there's the James Gunn side of it, the whole idea that everything is canon, like sharing different voice actors, trying to have these unified fronts for various characters. And you would think that somewhere along the line, there's been conversations with Rocksteady, even though, like I said, the heads have now left. Maybe those conversations are why they left, in regards to bringing together what Rocksteady can do, the caliber of that studio, making either a new Batman for the new Batman or a Superman game or whatever it is, and just hoping it all unifies in the end. I increasingly don't think it can,
but I
hope that there's a positive resolution eventually, and whatever plans are in motion for Suicide Squad get seen through rather than things get cut off, people get fired and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So we'll see. We've been here for days, Josh Brown.
Scott Telford, you know what? It turned into like a really negative podcast. We started it like shout out some great games and the games we're looking forward to, and then it was like, oh, the business is doing a business again.
Yeah.
Is it, hey?
Oh, brilliant. Permeation of the business. Also, the industry's ending, so don't worry about it. Games industry's over after Stellar Blade.
Hey, that's pretty fortunate for you.
It works out for me.
You won't miss much.
I'll go pop a sprog and then he'll be playing stuff next year. It's fine. First game, GTA 6. For now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Oh, I hit the microphone. Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you, and we'll catch you later in the week.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.